Welcome to the Volunteer Youth Worker Podcast. Youth ministries rise and fall on the volunteers, so we are here to encourage and equip you. Join the conversation as we tackle the practical questions you are asking so you can help the next generation know Jesus.
Well, folks, welcome back to the Volunteer Youth Worker Podcast. I'm joined today by my two friends, and we have worked together, so this is legitimately friends. Lindsay, I feel like we're less of friends only because we haven't spent a lot of time doing ministry, but Rick and I have been on our conference tour in the years past that we've done, our YWC conferences, and then in terms of research projects, you guys have been a part of the big ones in our country of Canada, of which we've partnered with you guys. How many research projects have you guys done, Lindsay?
Well, the projects that I've been on, I've done two. I believe Rick's done a lot more because you have hemorrhaging faith, renegotiating faith. There was a missions project.
So at least Bible five. Engagement project.
But yeah, that's right.
Small church one.
Small church one, yeah.
That's wild.
And then the one we're talking about today, parenting faith.
Which is so fun. And so for everybody listening, this is going to be a conversation based out of this research project. And so Rick and Lindsay, why don't you guys start by introducing yourselves and then we'll talk a bit about the project. But for everybody listening, you just got to know this is maybe not research like you've thought of. This is going to be fascinating. This is going to be, I think, going to give us some really clear ideas and next steps as youth workers. And already the conversations coming out of this project are a little bit mind-blowing. So let me just make sure that you know. It's going to be fascinating. But Rick, introduce yourself, fill people in. Who are you? Where are you coming from?
Well, I am the director of the EFC's Center for Research on Church and Faith. I've been working in a research role with the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada since 2007. And prior to that, I did all kinds of things like teach high school mathematics and computer science. I pastored a church and I counted stock in Canadian Tire's warehouse in Brampton.
That is going a little ways back. We don't have to go that far back, but I appreciate the Canadian Tire reference because we got people that live outside of our country of Canada. And so for any of you listening, the other fun part about when we talk about our Canadian research is sometimes, depending on where you're coming from, one of the things that we're seeing culturally in our country in this kind of post-Christian place, time, can be perhaps prescriptive for you, depending on, again, the context and the culture that you're in. But we've definitely noticed that. We've had feedback, actually, Rick, from some of our American listeners who have downloaded and gone through our research project because they're like, oh, this is telling us kind of where we're about to end up. So anyways, it's good to have you on. Rick, Lindsay, fill people in. Where are you from? Where are you at? What's your role in the research?
Sure. So I'm a researcher with the Center for Research on Church and Faith, and I've been with the EFC for just under 4 years. I'm also a pastor's wife, and we live in Ottawa. So we're kind of in the middle of, you know, the kind of the heart of the nation's capital and working in church life. And so we're kind of exposed on a few fronts of just what it means to be in Canada, what it means to be in the church, and trying to raise our family in that context.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, so now this project that you guys did, one of you just introduced, what was the heart behind it? How did you start it? What's it actually about? Research question or however you want to describe it.
Yeah, so this is a partnership of 17 organizations, including Youth Worker Community. Thank you for your participation. It started out of a concern that about what resources parents needed to disciple their kids in the home. And back in 2019, way back then, this is where that conversation started. And we realized that there were lots of resources for parents, but it didn't seem like they were using them. And so we sort of set out to find out what kinds of supports do parents need as they disciple their kids.
And so that's a fascinating question. How do you actually approach that? Because as a practitioner, it's like, oh, I think, oh, I probably read a book or I talk to a couple people. But what does it mean to actually do research on that particular thing? Maybe, Lindsay, you can fill people in.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, we're really coming at this from, we wanted to know what are parents doing at home. So we knew we had to read some books. Like, as you said, we'll read some books about, you know, what research has been done, what are people saying families should do, And then we'll talk to some experts. We'll all talk to people who are working in family ministry, youth ministry, children's ministry. We'll talk to some academics. We'll talk to subject matter experts, people who might be social media influencers who are trying to disciple families through digital media. And then we wanted to talk to parents. We wanted to hear from Canadian evangelical parents with children under the age of 18 in the home. And just ask them, what are you doing? What are you doing to form the faith of your children at home? And then once we heard from parents, we used that information to form a survey. And we sent that out to our networks, to our partners' networks. And we got over 1,200 responses from parents across Canada who answered some questions about just what they're doing, some of the faith formation activities they do at home, what their children are doing. And so we got some really robust data about what is happening in evangelical homes in terms of passing the faith to the next generation. And that's how we approached our research.
Okay. So you've researched Canadian families, and like how many people would have responded? How many people are in the survey?
Over 1,200, and they represented over 3,000 children. So we didn't interview or survey children, but we surveyed parents who reported about what their children are doing. So we have over 1,200 parents represented, and then over 3,000 children represented. Yeah.
And that would be like parents that are Christian parents, right? Like this isn't just a general population. This is the specific, hey, people that would claim, you know, some level of faith.
That's right. And people who are, you know, connected to these networks that of Christian affiliates with the EFC. So we had, you know, Awana and Youth Worker Community and Focus on the Family. So people who are connected to those networks.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Okay. So for everybody listening, so you're a volunteer youth worker, the research project is taking a sampling of Christian parents. So you think about kids in your small group, probably just the ones, of course, that are coming from more faith-based home, maybe Christian kids, you know, kids that are attending church with their family or their families attend church. This is giving us a window into what's going on at home. Is that kind of fair to say?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's exactly what we set out to discover.
I love that. I love that. And for youth workers, like this is helpful because we often wonder, you know, what is our role? What is the family's role? How are they engaged in the faith of their students? Are they doing the things? And sometimes we wonder, maybe they're prioritizing, you know, sports over youth group. And why is that? And, you know, we've got our own bones to pick and questions that we wonder about. And in this research, you know, people will be able to access it through the show notes. So we'll link the way to get to the full report, the executive summary. And there's a lot of interesting things. So I found when I was just kind of breezing through, I found interesting things that maybe we don't necessarily need to talk about, but there's a lot of Christian families that assume their kids were going to experience religious persecution. Like that was an interesting finding. That's fair to say, right? A lot of them kind of assume that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. And then this quote from the executive summary, I just want to drop in for people because I think it's great. Parental confidence that they were doing a good job with faith formation seemed to rise the less they objectively did. the less parents would actually do, the more confident they were that, oh yeah, I'm doing a good job of raising my kids in the faith. So you guys have found lots of intriguing things. The one thing I would love for us to talk about, if that's all right with you guys, is you posed this question to parents, and I wanted you to tell people what the percentage was that agreed with it. This question, I want my children, so thinking of, you know, again, youth workers think, this is going out to parents, Christian parents, you're asking them, do you agree with the statement, I want my children to make their own religious choices without pressure from me? I want my children to make their own religious choices without pressure from me. How many people agreed with that statement?
It was 73%. So that was, if you combined the strongly agree and moderately agree, 73% agreed that they wanted to offer religious choice to their children without pressure.
Okay, so that's interesting to me. I don't know if that's interesting to you guys. I'm intrigued by that for so many different reasons, but one of which is I think, oh, that probably makes a little bit of sense. We like offering choice, but at the other side of it, I'm like, man, I wonder if we actually do our kids a disservice if we don't give some level of intentionality, or that could honestly feel a little bit like pressure. So what did you guys think when you saw that? Was that surprising to you guys? How do you, or maybe you're not allowed to be surprised as researchers. What's the ethics behind that, Rick?
Yeah, you know, well, we were a little bit surprised. So part of the background on this is that the parents themselves told us that when they were raised, they didn't feel that they had choice in terms of their religious faith, and they weren't given explanation. They were told, this is what we believe, and that's it. That's what our family does. And so a lot of them are reacting out of that. So that's part of it. The other part is that culturally there's been a shift in how we think about our beliefs. And you know, there's a Canadian philosopher, his name's Charles Taylor. He's famous in Quebec because he was part of the Bouchard-Taylor Commission that looked at how you do religious education in Quebec. And he writes about something called the authentic self. And I think that what Taylor's describing as the authentic self, this is the major religious competitor to Christianity in Canada today. We've seen lots of data in our previous studies about how when people leave Christianity, they're not becoming Muslim, Buddhist, or Hindu. Typically, they're becoming religious nuns. And there's sort
just
of...
Just not a Catholic nun.
Not a Catholic nun. That's right.
Yes, that's an important distinction, because that would have been very confusing.
Yes.
they're affiliating with no religion. Is that...
Affiliated with no religion. And often there is a philosophical, and I would argue even a religious idea underneath this, and this is what Taylor describes.
So what you're saying is that when people choose to unaffiliate, and this is funny, I've been listening to a little bit of what is that popular atheist? There's four of them, and
Christopher Hitchens,
you know, but the other one, Sam Harris. And you know, when you hear atheists talk, they'll often try to, you know, wiggle out of this particular thing. We would say when people unaffiliate with religion, they do affiliate with a different worldview. And I think, is that kind of what you're describing here, Rick, is that these are competing worldviews, even if it's not necessarily a religious system that they're moving into.
Yeah, you know, sort of at the risk of committing philosophy here. So what Taylor says is that way back in Europe, once upon a time, there were wicked kings, and the church was corrupt, and different people were trying to figure out a way to solve this problem of abuse of power. And so what different philosophers like Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau did is they posited this idea of what would we be like in a state of nature. And this was a kind of a stripped down me. If we could strip away government, religion, all of these things, and we were just left with our core, what could we rebuild the world like? And they had different ideas, but the one that's really important for our day was Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And what Jean-Jacques Rousseau said was that we are good until society makes us bad. And so right away, we're going back to this is like a creation myth, right? This is a Genesis story about what's at the beginning of the world, what are we like at the beginning of the world, and where does sin come from? So sin comes from outside of me. I am good until the rest of you make me bad. And significantly, there's a different anthropology, you know, that goes along with this. So there's the good me, and then there's the me that society makes me into. And so all of our identity issues in the world now sort of grow out of this idea that Rousseau started. And so there's a lot of time that kind of goes between Rousseau and our modern day, but this is what Taylor talks about. So he says with the authentic self, you have the deep me, and you know when people are talking about that because they'll talk about who I really am. Who I really am is code for the deep me that is good. And then there is the me that my parents are trying to make me into, that my youth group leader is trying to make me into, that you're pushing on me and everything. And that me, this is potentially the bad me. And so what salvation is then, Taylor says, is recovering contact with your true authentic self. And so you're trying to discover who you are. And Taylor further says that only I can do that. So all of the identity formation is hard work stuff that we looked at in Hemorrhaging Faith and that you see people working through in the Renegotiating Faith study of the Emerging Adulthood. All of that, that hard work is hard work because if you help me find who I really am, then what you're really doing is putting something on me. You're shaping my identity, and then it's not authentic because it's not mine. So the principle that everyone has to discover their own identity is there. And then the last thing that Taylor says is that you only know you've discovered your authentic self if what you find there is unique. And so this is why we have all of this sort of creative effort put into the authentic self, because that's the only way that you can tell if you've found it is if it's different than everyone else. And this has enormous consequences for how we do faith formation, because if my faith is a deep part of who I am and my faith looks like your faith, Jeremy, then I haven't found my faith. I found yours. And what's more is if you've been telling me about Jesus and encouraging me to believe this deposit of the faith, this biblical faith, then you've been imposing an identity on me. And I have to reject that. And furthermore, because my salvation is in not in reconnecting with God, but in reconnecting with myself, if you prevent me from finding my unique self, then you're preventing me from being saved. You're actually preventing me from being saved. And so, you know, the way I try to make this concrete is by talking about movies. And, you know, one of my favorite movies is the Bourne Identity series. And if you know in the Bourne Identity series, Jason Bourne has two identities, right? He's Jason Bourne, but his who he really is David Webb. And when he's Jason Bourne, his wicked handlers from the CIA program Treadstone are telling him who he is. And he's doing wicked things. But he's saved when he discovers that he's David Webb. And you see, the way that sin falls off is that you just realize that that wasn't me. And so it's not that my sin needs to be atoned for. I have to realize that the sins that I committed weren't really me. Or you see this in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? Thor Ragnarok. So you've got Thor. He's in this movie. He's in a conflict with his sister Hela, who is this goddess who is so much stronger than him, and they're having this battle, and she's got him by the throat, and he's almost ready to die. And it's not that help comes over the hill to help him. Rather, he reaches deep down inside to connect deeper with himself. And at that point, his eyeballs light up and flash thunder, and he finds the strength to beat his sister. But the point is that salvation came from an interior connection. And you can go on in our culture. Like, you've got every Disney movie, especially the ones aimed at young girls, are all about rediscovering that you are a princess. Usually with Disney, it's a princess or something like that, right? But that your ordinary lives, the lives that people try to put on you, is really damnation.
Okay, so then this philosophy, this idea, is infused in how parents are resisting putting any kind of pressure on their student, because they themselves have felt this whole philosophy work out in their own life. Is that what you're saying?
I would say to an extent, but think about even just how espousing this philosophy changes the role of the parent. It's not about, you know, directing a child in what to believe. It's suggesting or exposing a child to options for faith. And so parents tend to, we notice that parents who generally want to prioritize choice for their children, their approach to faith formation was to focus on role modeling. I will model for my children what it's like to follow Jesus, but I'm not going to be directive. I'm not going to tell them what to believe. I might suggest what I believe or put them in environments that will expose them to a Christian faith, but I'm not going to prioritize or put my thumb on the scale in favor of Christianity necessarily. And so they might seek to expose their children to other faiths in the community or at school. So, and then we think about the role of extracurricular activities. This is an opportunity to let my child discover who they are by trying a lot of different things. And so, again, the role of the parent is sort of this, they function more as an agent or a manager trying to help their child discover who they are rather than having more of a directive role in faith formation.
And so would you say that maybe is part of the reason why oftentimes we see as youth workers this parents aren't as interested in getting their kid to youth group. Like they'll prioritize some of these other things, you know, but hey, our program is just one of a list of a dozen things that these kids are involved in. And the minute that a student isn't as interested in our experience together, our small group or our program, whatever it might be, it's challenging to convince parents to bring any level of pressure on their kid to actually still attend.
Right. Because the important thing is the child's free choice to discover who they are. And, you know, we were talking a little bit about this before we pressed record today, but even for youth workers, sometimes youth workers reach out into the community to bring kids in that aren't part of a church culture, and they run into this kind of conflict with parents. But this is because parents, in many cases, are reluctant to disciple their kids too strongly at home. And so they bring their kids to youth group, and that's where they're going to get exposed to Christianity. So there's this Christian socialization, this presentation of the Christian message that they expect the church to take over, but now you bring in unchurched kids and you sort of ruin their plan for what youth group should be in their kids' lives. Hmm. Because we're not going to do it at home. We expect exposure, not pressure, but exposure to happen at youth group, and now you've taken away the opportunity for exposure.
Okay, so, I mean, this begs the big question, but maybe we can't answer it, is that the right approach? So this is what most people are doing, you know, free choice, elevate free choice. And again, this is why, even for me, as I'm looking through it, I'm like, oh, in one sense, I mean, I'm a product of my time, I guess, and the philosophy of the day. That makes a lot of sense. But the minute that I start to think like, oh, but we don't want to pressure our students, I also get completely switched around to think, yeah, but they're experiencing so much pressure of a different and conflicting worldview. And so the idea that we would just say, hey, you've got your free choice is not necessarily being the same. That's not the rules that everybody's playing by. And so, you know, the minute that they log on to TikTok, the algorithm is going to feed them a worldview pretty strongly and very, very much of with a pressure or suggestion, based on what, you know, the algorithm knows is they're going to be intrigued by. So how do we wrestle with that? Or was that at all a part of the research in terms of the conflicting worldviews?
Well, I think you're right, Jeremy, that there is almost a myth of our kids as free choosers, right? Sometimes, you know, when we sort of step back from our interviews, there's a sense that parents expect that their kids are going to graduate from high school and move out of the home and go out and stand in a field all by themselves without anything influencing them. And they're going to kind of spread out the things that they've been exposed to, and they're going to choose one. But we know that that's not how the world works. But even, you know, I think it's important to point out that parents' reluctance to be directive with their kids grows out of a conviction of the illegitimacy of presenting something as true. It's because there's this idea that those who do that are necessarily taking advantage of you. And so fundamentally, there's this breakdown in trust or even in the possibility of relationships where I can be in relationship with somebody and they may have my best interests at heart. Our culture has a very, very difficult time believing that anyone in a position of power or authority could ever handle that well.
Yeah, but I mean, I get that, and yet it's there's something about a perceived free choice that I can offer power and authority to an influencer over my life. But we would recognize as adults that there's not a lot of that free choice. So I just think about, like, yes, the perceived authority figure, the perceived power structure, you know, there's a resistance to that. And yet our teenagers every day would align themselves and give power and authority to other voices in their world very, very freely and openly. And you know, whatever influencer they're tracking with or YouTuber that they're following, they'll gladly hand that role over to somebody. And again, I wouldn't think that it's necessarily this benevolent, free option, but instead they've been served up those particular influencers fairly clearly.
I think there's a level of abstraction with YouTube. These people aren't right in front of me. And I think that there's a sense that in the same way that on social media, all of these posts roll by you, that you have the illusion that you're picking from these choices. Mm-hmm. When in actual fact, there are algorithms that are curating the things that you may choose from, but you have the illusion that you're choosing. And one of the things that Lindsay noticed, that even when parents are looking for help with how do they disciple their kids, we tend to go to non-relational choices. We tend to go to choices where at least we feel that we are the ones that are picking and choosing, and relationships aren't getting in the way of that.
It's interesting. I want to maybe hear about that, but I also want to make sure that this maybe brings us back to this core question. Cause I'm still wondering, should we pressure our kids to follow Jesus? Should we do more than just model? Should we hope that people do more than just model faith for them?
Well, yes, I think we should. But we also saw that parents who just teach the faith, there's also deficits there. Children tend to lack what we called religious skills development. If parents relied exclusively on modeling, or if parents relied exclusively on teaching content. And so we really need to see this marriage of the two, where and opportunities for children to participate and to develop these faith skills. So if you do, I mean, can you think of a time where you were taught how to pray and then invited to pray? We're not sure that children are necessarily getting that kind of instruction, or how to read and interpret the Bible. You can watch your parent do it, or you can be told what to think, but then you put a Bible in a child's hands, or do they know how to distinguish between, you know, reading the prophets and reading a gospel? Are they, so, you know, are we giving our children the tools? And I think that's largely going to be a marriage of modeling and teaching, but as well as a very intentional, maybe, sort of apprenticeship approach to teaching the skills that are required and involved. But again, this is a lifestyle. This is sort of the culture of the home. It's got to really be woven into the fabric of what you are doing. Have you structured family life to invite people in, including your children? And so as Rick mentioned, parents, when they think about, you know, how can I be equipped to form the faith of my children and disciple my children? They tend to be looking to books, to podcasts, to social media, and to friends. But these are people that the parents are choosing. They're things that you can, you know, turn off or tune out if you don't like what you're hearing. And it also, they tend to be built on it, like the friendships tend to be built on affinity. So you tend to surround yourself with people who are like you. So where are you being challenged? Where are the parents being formed themselves? We saw the previous generation was very low on the list. The church was very low on the list of resources for parents as they think about what it means to be equipped to form the faith of their children. And so there are deficits just in terms of what parents are accessing. And then we're seeing deficits in children's abilities to be able to use their faith and apply their faith, because they're either offered just content through teaching, or they're just offered sort of this model of what they could do, but they don't know why these things are being done.
And, you know, Jeremy, there's always this question about what is faith transmission? And, you know, on one level, we don't know the disposition of people's hearts, right? We don't know the work of God in their hearts. But if you're a researcher and you're trying to sort of measure, was faith transmitted? Usually what you do is you look for similar behaviors in parents and kids. So did the parents pass on those behaviors? And so one of the things that we measured was faith formation activities like Bible reading, prayer, worship music, those kinds of things. And the reason that you do this is because everybody's faith needs to have practices that keep it strong. It's like, you know, one of the models for our faith is, you know, it's like a body, right? If you don't feed it, if you don't exercise it, it gets weak and it starts to die. And so we measured, I think, about 17 of these things, and we looked at the different ages, and, you know, was what we would expect if faith was being transmitted is that the frequency with which kids did these faith formation activities should converge with what their parent, the frequency with which their parents were doing them. And so, you know, it's fair comment for people to say, well, my kid doesn't have to do exactly the thing that I'm doing. But then the question that you would want to follow that up with is, so what are the faith formation practices that are going to keep you close to Jesus? And we're kidding ourselves if we think that we don't need some of those in our lives. And our research shows that kids' faith formation practices tend to peak around age 9 or 10 and then decline. And some of this is differentiation. But where kids are forming their own identity apart from their parents, so they're putting the distance there. But then that just backs the question up to our church communities: is their modeling, is their teaching in the community about these faith formation practices from other people that could influence kids to pick up these practices? And really, the whole point of these practices are to keep directing you back to Jesus. And it's pretty clear from our research that at least this isn't happening often enough. And unless there is some change in kids' lives, they do not have the practices in their lives going into adulthood that are going to be able to sustain their relationship with Christ.
Hmm. Would you say their practices and also the beliefs?
Yes, and also the beliefs, right? But the practice, but our beliefs are sustained within a context. You know, we've known for years, if I could just ask one question to know something about somebody's religious beliefs, faith life, everything, I would ask the frequency of their religious service attendance. And a lot of people get really upset about that. But what happens when you go to church is that there's the positive peer pressure of other believers. The word of God is preached. You're encouraged to give. You're encouraged to volunteer. You're encouraged to be temperate. All of the virtues, the fruit of the Spirit, are encouraged in your life. And it's because of that context where there is both teaching and modeling and accountability. And so our kids need that as well.
That's big. Okay, so I don't want to move too fast beyond that, but one of the better markers of overall, how would you say that, Rick? The one question you would ask?
Well, the one question to know your spiritual temperature, and this is controversial in our culture because of this authentic self stuff where I am the measure of my beliefs. But if you want to know somebody's spiritual temperature, it will be measured by their engagement with Christian community. Mm-hmm. And this is just because, you know, all kinds of counterexamples notwithstanding, other Christians are just good peer pressure.
Fascinating. Okay. Well, there's a lot. We've talked about a lot of things. I'm just thinking about our youth workers, volunteers on the front lines. This is important information. If I can repeat back maybe what I'm hearing, because the question that we kind of zeroed in on is this, should we want students, teenagers, kids, should we want them to make their own religious choices without any pressure? And I think what I'm hearing from you is that we get better outcomes if we both model faith and also teach faith. And in the midst of both of those things, there is an element of social pressure, and that might be actually okay. Or am I putting words in your guys' mouths?
There's a role for relational accountability. But I think, I mean, what's going to be the difference is if the child knows that they are known and loved by a person, because they are not known and loved by that YouTuber or that person on TikTok. So there's an element of relational intimacy, I think, that is key, that will be compelling and offer maybe this alternative kind of community and experience than what they're getting from their curated digital influencers.
And I think, you know, Lindsay's really hit on something that's very key. You know, so a lot of the sociologists that we would read would talk about warm relationships. And so kids are far more likely to adopt their parents' beliefs if they have warm relationships with them. But this is so important. Our modern culture with social media is fundamentally alienating. And what I mean by that, an alien is somebody who doesn't belong here, right? My wife went to school at Wheaton College in the United States. And when she was there, she was called a resident alien. And that's just the American's way of making sure she knows she doesn't belong here. And in our culture, social media is alienating. And for this reason, what it does is you don't exist unless you continue to post. And so there's all of this work. And once you don't post and people don't see you and your feedback, all the quantifications give you the feedback. If you don't see those there, then you're not there and you've lost your place. And that's the way in which it's alienating if you don't do all of that work. And fundamentally, you know, as we project identities, as we create them online for ourselves, what we are trying to do is to find something compelling that will get that kind of response. For kids to have an alternative on the side where there are people that love them, not because they can make a cool video, not because they can have a witty critique of a video or something like that, but they love them because they're there, because of who they are, because they're part of a community, because you're maybe in a family context, because you're part of a family, and those relationships are warm. Now I have a place. And what social media does is it takes away your place over and over again, unless you post to find one, and then it's ephemeral. It lasts a couple of seconds until people scroll up. And it creates a whole dynamic about faith, because our faith is a part of our identity, right? But how do you find an identity that is solid, that is part of a covenant community, that isn't something that you have to work at in order to get approval?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've heard Tim Keller talk a little bit about that. The idea that this identity that we offer, that we have as Christians, is one that we don't achieve, that we get to receive. And that's a unique proposition, I think, in our world today when it comes to identity formation. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And we have to offer that to our kids. So we have to point them to Christ and what Christ offers to our kids. You know, some of this comes out in the language that we use with our kids. And I find myself doing this too. What do we say to our kids? What do you want to be when you grow up? there's an anthropology in that, because there's two me's. There's me that doesn't know what me wants, right? There's the me that knows what I want, but I don't have access to that me. This is Taylor's authentic self and that whole anthropology encapsulated in a statement where we're asking our kids to frame their whole lives. Mm. And you know, when we talk about emerging adulthood, where kids get stuck is that they're trying to find an identity, but if they don't find an identity that's instantly celebrated by people around them, they got to try again. Because that's the only way that you know that you are good. Mm. It's not that you're loved by Christ, who died for to pay the penalty for your sins. It's that I need to come up with an identity that the people around me are going to celebrate. Mm. And if I can't do that, then I'm stuck. Mm-hmm. Because how could I settle for something that isn't celebrated?
Yeah. Okay. So on that note, we're going to start pressuring kids to follow Jesus a little bit more.
Compel them. I think Spurgeon.
Compel them.
Spurgeon has this line, or compel them to come.
I love that. That's a great place to wrap up. Spurgeon's quote, compel them to come to Jesus. And if we can do that, that would be, I think, a beautiful thing. You guys, there's obviously a lot more to mine out of this. And so you got to tell people, how do they access the research? We'll link it in the show notes. Anything that you want them to know going from here. Lindsay?
Yeah, it's parentingfaith.ca. That's where you'll find the report, the executive summary, and then research at theefc.ca. You can contact us with any questions or comments. Want to know, we want to get this out there. We want people to be able to respond and to just lead the next generation to Christ.
Mm-hmm. I love it. You guys are fantastic. Thanks for your hard work on this stuff. I'm sure we'll have you back, and I'm sure we'll have you involved in our events in the future. But for right now, I appreciate this conversation. And for everybody listening, we'll see you back next time for another conversation here on the Volunteer Youth Worker Podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.